Okay, so we left our hero.
So you're not going to talk about your trip to Mexico?
The trip was wonderful. It was to Mexico and to New York. I participated in a couple of debates. What's that? I'm sorry, I didn't. Oh, the debate in Mexico was, does life have meaning? In other words, the debate was really whether there's meaning that is intrinsic to life or whether human beings create their own meaning. The atheist side was people create their own meaning. Our side was mostly, at least mostly, that there is meaning inherent in life. And we fulfill the meaning that is there or don't fulfill the meaning that is there. That was the debate in Mexico. And there were a lot of other wonderful speakers. It's a tremendous conference. Then, what's that? No, Puebla, which is a couple hours outside of Mexico City. And then the last night we had dinner at the governor's mansion, which almost rivals some of the smaller Beverly Hills homes. And they had, you know, dancers and Mexican and mariachi bands and so on. But I'll tell you this, it is not a, Mexico, Puebla in particular, the conference had already arranged, but Puebla in particular, not a good place for vegetarians. I was sitting at a table of people who spoke English, but all of them spoke Spanish. And I tried to get them to communicate to the waiter that I needed a vegetarian meal, so they brought a salad. Finally, after several iterations of this, I took a small bite of the salad and I looked down and it was filled with salami. Oh! And I said to the guy next to me, like, you know, what? And he said, I he was really apologetic. He was a really nice guy. He was an architect. And he was a friend of Salinas, Ricardo Salinas, is the guy who sponsors the conference. And he said, we just don't get this vegetarian thing down here. You know, it was like, did you ever see My Big Fat Greek Wedding?
Yes.
Where he said, you don't eat meat? You don't eat meat? It's okay, I make veal, you know? That's what it was like, I swear. Okay, he doesn't have meat, then only salami. But that they had rolls. And basically, I had rolls and water and a little wine for dinner, and I felt fine. And they had both, believe it or not. And dessert, well, I'm sure dessert was good. I left a little early. This is my MO, right, exactly. Let me put it this way. The way the Mexicans do it, they go not quite as late as the Persians. That's basically how, so. So, but close, and as it was getting late, and really, and I had a flight the next day to New York, and so on, and then I had the great pleasure. The last panel of the conference was Oliver Stone, who I'm not a big fan of, but that's Mark Spitz, Paul Krugman from the New York Times, and Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times. So, on the way back from to the airport, which is about a two-hour drive, I was in the car with this guy who teaches, does he teach at Harvey Mudd? I think he teaches at Harvey Mudd. His name is Arthur Benjamin. He's called the Math Magician. He does like really wonderful and brilliant stuff with mathematics and with numbers and so on. And he's a really entertaining, fun guy. And he and his wife and his daughter were in the car, and also Nicholas Kristof and his daughter from the New York Times. So it was a good, it was an interesting conversation, especially about the next debate, which was in New York, which was whether religion is good for the world. And there I was paired with the same guy that I was paired with in Mexico, Dinesh D'Souza. And I'll come back to him in a second. And then the people on the other side were A.C. Grayling, who is an English philosopher, and Matthew Chapman, who's a producer and a screenwriter, but also is a head of a foundation to bring science into the public debate. He tries to get presidential candidates to address science and scientific issues, and also happens to be the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin on his mother's side. So, and both of them, although Chapman lives now in the United States and is a citizen. Both of them, unfortunately, have British accents, which is not helpful. And D'Souza, who was born in India and lives in America, has no accent whatsoever. I mean, has an American accent, basically. The IQ, this is part of a series of debates called IQ Squared that they do in New York and they do in London, and they may be bringing to San Francisco. And you can look them up online. They do all sorts of debates. The next one is going to be about Israel-Palestine. They've done, I don't know how many, but they are increasingly, they started off already well-publicized, and they're increasingly well-publicized. They were broadcast on, the debate was broadcast live over 200 NPR stations across the country, not Los Angeles's, but many others, and is also going to be shown at WNET, which is the PBS station in New York, on Sunday night, and it's co-sponsored by Bloomberg, NPR, and Slate Magazine, the online magazine. So it got covered in a blog for the New York Times and a bunch of other things. And the way they do it is it's very clever, and based on Oxford-style debates. They have little mechanisms at each seat. There were about 800 people there. They have mechanisms at each seat, and you vote beforehand for which of the propositions you favor. That was the yes or no. If you were voting yes, it means that you think the world is better off without religion. If you were voting no, it's that you don't think so. So I was arguing for the no proposition. And then afterwards, you vote for who argued better. Not whether you've changed your mind, but who argued better from the... there were two things I think that really hurt us. We ended up losing by 2 percentage points, which the guy who edits Slate magazine said to me was within the margin of error. So if I want to, I can think of it as a tie. But because they changed minds from 52% to 59%, and we changed minds from 26, we started off much lower, 26% to 31%. So we changed 5 percentage points, they changed 7. It was clear that the audience, I mean, it was in New York, you know, it was close to the Village. It was at the Skirball Center, which is way downtown. You knew that the people there were going to be by and large hostile to religion. And in fact, they were, which was fine. That's okay. That makes the debate more interesting. But I think there were two things that hurt. First of all, is that Dinesh D'Souza, my debating partner, who did very well, but he's a very well-known, well-identified, politically active conservative. And this was not, I mean, this was in New York, largely Jewish. It was at the Skirball Center, Jewish crowd. I think they were very predisposed not to be favorable to him. And also, I wish he hadn't, when he was talking about, and I have to talk to him about this sometime, when he was talking about the question of what a hypocrite is, as opposed to just not doing everything that you should do, he used the Pharisees as an example, which, of course, is used in the New Testament. But you know what we call the Pharisees? The rabbis. The Pharisees are the rabbis that Jesus was objecting to, and in front of a Jewish crowd, especially many of whom are literate Jewish, you don't start taking off after the Pharisees, not a really good strategy. So I think but it was a really, I thought it was a good, interesting debate. I will say between us that the moderator, John Donvan, who's moderated all of them, said to me afterwards he was shocked, he was sure that we had won the debate, and was actually shocked by the result and thought that it was not totally, you know, he thought that the crowd was predisposed to. But whether you thought we won the debate or not, it was a good debate. It really was. It was, the one in Mexico wasn't bad either, but I thought this one was more interesting and was better sort of structured and was kind of less kitschy. The one in Mexico, you got inside a boxing ring, believe it or not. So anyway, that was basically it. You're welcome to watch it if you're interested. They're both online. The Mexican one isn't online yet, but last year's was, and this year's will be. So there you have it. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Dialogue with David Suisa and Chaim Seidlerfeller is tonight at 7:00. I've met him before. I met him again. I talked to him for just a couple minutes. Yeah. He lives in the neighborhood.
He's
really?
How is he?
He's tall.
Yes, he's tall. He seems fine. I mean, he gave a talk about, they were all talking basically about how to achieve in the world. He gave essentially a motivational talk. So.
That's what he does.
Yeah, he's a motivational speaker. Motivational talk. Right. So. The other speakers that I heard were Daniel Tennant, who's this guy who's kind of on the Asperger autism spectrum somewhere, who memorized 22,000 some digits of pi. And he talked about what it was like. It was a very moving talk about what it was like growing up and what it's like relating to other people and so on. So that was one interesting talk. There was a woman who's Elizabeth Izquierdo, who's talked about her study of bonobos in Africa, which was also quite interesting. And another guy who talked about his study of baboons, I think, I don't know, a particular kind, who he said are the most vicious, cruel, loathsome creatures to each other. And he talked about how one colony wasn't and why that was and what implications that had for human society. Robert Sapolsky, I think he's out of New York. Who else did we saw some, a couple of musical acts and the panel and heard somebody who talked about dehumanization and genocide a couple of talks. Joseph Epstein, who's a wonderful friend of mine, talked about envy. They did one on the seven sins. So one talked about jealousy. They didn't do all the sins, but they did a couple of them. And Joseph Epstein talked about envy, which he said is the one sin that you get no satisfaction out of. He says, you know, like gluttony, you get some, so you eat, but envy, you just feel bad. So it was an entertaining talk. I think that's it. Okay, so let's go to chapter 45, shall we? Let's at least get some Torah under our belt. Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants. Now remember, this is right after Judah's speech. And if you recall, Judah made it clear that they were desperate not to hurt their father. Right? Look at the last couple, right before 45, chapter 45. Therefore, please let your I'm starting with verse 33. Please let your servant remain as a slave to my Lord instead of the boy, and let the boy, that is Benjamin, Joseph's full brother, go back with his brothers. For how can I go back to my father unless the boy is with me? Let me not be witness to the woe that would overtake my father. So now Joseph realizes that rather than sacrifice a brother, they would sacrifice themselves. Exactly the opposite of what they did to him, okay? When they sacrificed him instead of caring about their father. Because it's not just that that ultimately was who they were wounding, you know? I mean, yeah, they were obviously wounding Joseph. But they were wounding Jacob because they knew that Jacob loved Joseph best. And by hurting him, they were hurting their father, who had, after all, hurt them, right? Because when a parent loves one kid better than the other, it's not, you know. And by the way, we had this discussion actually in the jealousy. I had this discussion with the jealousy guy, David Livingston Smith, who is a philosopher, I think he's in Maine. He was part of the other team on the debate too, but a really nice guy. We were talking about parental love and jealousy. And I said, my sense is, of course, parents don't love their children equally. They love their children shiftingly. That is, sometimes you feel more love for one than you feel for the other, and sometimes you feel more love for the other than you feel for the first. Nobody loves equally all the time. I mean, that's, you know, human beings don't work that way. It's like if you say to me, which of the four of us did my parents love best, I would say that the answer is when. You know, sometimes one, sometimes the other. Sometimes you really, you know, yeah, you still love your kid, but you don't like your kid. You're saying, right now, I really don't like this kid, you know. But the next day, you might say, it's the most wonderful child in the world. So I think the same was true here, but still it was clear that Jacob had shown a favoritism. And again, it's because Joseph was Rachel's son, and he loved Rachel. So now Joseph knows that the brothers have changed their orientation. It says, Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, have everyone withdraw from me. So there was no one else about when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. Now, why was there no one else about? I mean, there are lots of speculations from the commentators. One is that, you know, it was just a personal moment. He didn't want non-family members there. One was that he didn't want his the people who were his servants to see him as anything other than regal and kingly and so on. He didn't want them to see him human. It's the exact opposite, after all, of what we like from our politicians, right? Although the truth is we only like a certain sort of kind of humanness, because if you remember, if you are old enough to remember, Ed Muskie basically lost the nomination because he cried, right? Which you wouldn't think, you would think that would humanize him, but it didn't. In fact, what it did was it made him look weak. And my guess is in ancient Egypt, it's even worse to look weak than it is in modern America, right? And then the other speculation is that now for the first time Joseph was speaking to them in Hebrew, sent everyone out, and this was, and anyway, so Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone withdraw from me." So there's no one else about when he made himself known to his brothers. Her sobs were so loud that the Egyptians could hear. So the news reached Pharaoh's palace, which is a beautiful detail in a way, right? They were outside the room, but they could hear him weeping. And the first thing they did, they couldn't go back in. The first thing they did was run to Pharaoh and say, "I don't know what's going on, but Joseph's crying like a baby," right? I'm paraphrasing. I don't know what they said. Right. I don't know what they said, but Joseph said to his brothers, "Ani Yosef, I am Joseph," right? And then his first question is, he doesn't actually say, "Is my father still well?" Right? Look at the Hebrew. What does he say? Is he alive? Right? Ha'od avi chai. Now, why do they translate it as, "Is my father still well?" Because they've just told him he's alive. They just said, we don't want to go back without Benjamin because it'll kill him. So that implies that he's still alive, right? And so they translate it as, "He's still well." But you could imagine that Joseph is so anxious about the reality that he would still ask, not just is he well, but is he still alive, right? Because it's been a lot of years now. It's been decades. And that's really what he, and it feels as though the pressure to know that question is what forces his revelation. He needs to know if his father is still alive and well. But his brothers couldn't answer him, so dumbfounded were they on account of him. And you can imagine, it's been 20 years. The last person they expected, and they don't recognize him, which is also the subject, we talked about it before, but we can just review it for a second. Did he grow a beard? Is it because he was speaking Egyptian? Is it just because it's been decades? Is it because they assume he's dead? Because, I mean, all those things are possible, but whatever the answer is, it's clear that they have absolutely no, they're struck dumb, literally. They don't know what to say at the idea. Joseph said to his brothers, "Come forward to me." And when they came forward, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, he whom you sold to Egypt. Now do not be distressed or reproach yourself because you sold me here. It was to save life that God sent me ahead of you." Okay? So far, that's an extremely magnanimous speech. Okay? Don't worry. It's okay. Don't be distressed about it. He doesn't just say, "I'm Joseph." His first comment was, "I'm Joseph." But his second comment is, "I'm Joseph, your brother." So he still considers himself their brother. That's very powerful, right? It's now 2 years that there's been famine in the land, and there are still 5 years to come in which there will be no yield from tilling. God sent me ahead of you to ensure your survival on earth and to save your lives in an extraordinary deliverance. Now it's a little, you know, right, exactly, yep, right, yes. God sent me so I could save you, and you know it's what's it? Yes, and leflitag dola is exactly that—not just a a miracle, not just a wonderful thing, but a really wonderful thing. Gedolah means big. They translate an extraordinary deliverance, right? So now you have to give him a certain amount of, but he's explaining to them. And then he says, so it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh, lord of all his household, and ruler over the whole land of Egypt. So you didn't even do it. God did it. And whether you think that's comforting to the brothers or not is an interesting question, right? Because what I see in this, and I don't remember if a commentator said it this way, but what I see in this is in some ways an exact repetition of what hurt them in the first place. That is, Dad, but this time it's God, always loved me best. I mean, isn't that what he's saying, right? It wasn't you guys, it was God. And and we all know that your concept of God is not completely unrelated to your concept of Father. And he's saying, God took care of me, just like Dad always took care of me. I'm the favored one. Now, it also happens to be true in the context of the Bible. It's exactly right. But you can imagine how the brothers feel. And everything, I mean, it's not as though their resentment of Joseph has disappeared just because Joseph has disappeared, right? Resentments linger on long after people are gone, right? You can still be upset at somebody who's dead and gone. So you can certainly be upset at somebody who's just disappeared from your view. And you can imagine that the brothers feel all sorts of things. First of all, they're scared, right? How can you not be scared? You almost killed your brother, sold him into slavery, and now he's got the power of life and death over you, over your family, over your food, over everything. Second, they must still resent him in some way, right? Because they sold him in part because he lorded over them, and now he's literally lording over them. But also there's gotta be a part of them that feels relieved and some sense of love, right? He's still their brother, and he still survived, and he's still okay, and they must have thought many times in the intervening years, I killed my brother. They must have thought that. Yeah. Okay, we'll stop for a minute. Go ahead.
Does that mean that Joseph has forgiven his brother?
That is the 24th, 64, whatever $1,000 question. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. What do you think? The question was, does this mean that Joseph has forgiven his brothers? We have to get to the end of the story before we can decide whether that's true. Yeah. Yes. Could it be that he was genuinely comforting them? That's what most of the commentators assume. And I think that here's what I would say. I'm not suggesting that he's trying to make them feel bad. I'm suggesting that everything you say, especially in such an emotional situation, has lots of levels. Lots of levels. And there's a level on which he's comforting them, and there's a level on which he's reminding them how, I mean, look, he feels proud too. Look what he did. They sold him into slavery and now he's ruling Egypt. So, and who's he gonna brag to except the people who know him? He's not gonna brag to his servants. He's not gonna brag to Pharaoh. The only people that he's gotten a chance in 20 years to brag to are his brothers, right? Because they remember him back when. So it's like going to the reunion. And what do? You know? Actually, I'm Vice President of the United States. And how about you? You know? That's what he basically is. So, yeah, Andrew.
So, why does he say, I am Joseph, twice?
Because I think they were so shocked that he wanted to make them take it in. It was stunning, you know? First he says, I'm Joseph. And I think also, when he saw their puzzlement, that might have led him to say, I'm Joseph, your brother. Like, I'm that Joseph, you know? I'm not just, which as I told you in this beautiful, beautiful scene, Pope John the 23rd, right? I think it was Pope John the 23rd, who was the Pope after the Holocaust, extremely sympathetic to the Jews. When Jules Isaac, the historian of the Holocaust, the French historian of the Holocaust, who wrote a searing book about the Catholic Church and their place in the Holocaust, he was called to an audience with the Pope. And when he came to the audience, Pope John came off the papal throne and said to him, I am Joseph, your brother. Which was very, yeah, very powerful. Very powerful. So, yeah. Yes, but pride is so, well, but why did God choose him? So yeah, in one way, yes, but in another way, you know, he's maybe an instrument of God, but after all, he was the chosen instrument. So it's very hard to root out that sense of, you know, that sense of pride from human beings. And as I said, it all always works on lots of levels. And you can use, you know, this is I'll give you an example from the debate the other night. You can also, if you've got enough under your belt, you can use the Bible for lots of different purposes. I think it's chapter 16, but I don't remember if it was 16. So the other night, it's Ezekiel. But the other night in the debate, here it is. One of the things that A.C. Grayling, who's an English philosopher, he talked about a conversation he had with a cab driver and why Sodom was destroyed. And he was saying that it was destroyed because of sodomy, which is homosexuality. And he was making that point that, you know, England was, and I said, the cab driver, maybe you suffer from an inadequate religious education. Because actually in Ezekiel, it says quite clearly that it doesn't say anything about sodomy. It never says in the Bible that Sodom is destroyed because of homosexuality. It says in Ezekiel, the sin of Sodom was arrogance. She didn't support the poor and the needy. That's what Ezekiel says is the sin of Sodom. Doesn't say sodomy. It was kind of funny, actually. I cited all these statistics, and I'll tell you about them in a second, and they kept quoting biblical verses and saying, look at this verse. This verse says bad things, and that verse says bad things. What happened was I had before, like a week before I went to Mexico and New York, I had been at a conference on spirituality and medicine where Harold Koenig, who's the dean of this field, was speaking, and he was talking about the Oxford Handbook of Religion and Health that's coming out in 2012. Did I mention this last class? Maybe I didn't. Anyway, the new Oxford Book of Religion and Health is coming out, based on over 3,000 peer-reviewed studies in medical journals, like the leading medical journals, about people who are in religious communities, and that's defined by church synagogue attendance, whether you read Bible, whether you pray, okay? So like measurable things. And people who are involved in religious communities, I'm just going to give you a little excerpt from it. They they have lower levels of depression, of suicide, of drinking, of drugs, greater marital stability, greater volunteering, greater giving to charity, even, by the way, non-religious charities, right? Religious people give to non-religious charities a much higher rate than religious people do. I mean, than non-religious people do. And it adds, on average, 7 years to your life if you're a white American male, and 14 years if you're an African American male. The study apparently was done primarily with men about this, so he and averaged out about that. But obviously for women too, all the statistics that apply where both are studied equally apply to women as well as to men. That's all he said, so I don't know what the, it may be that the variation for women is smaller, so Koenig quoted only the one for men because it sounded, anyway. But he said, and I actually repeated this in New York, Koenig said, now it's true that you spend those 7 years in synagogue, so you know, you may choose to spend them otherwise, but nonetheless. And it's very, the studies are very powerful. And so I gave a little bit of an elaboration of that, but basically I cited all these studies, and on the other side they were saying, yes, but it says in Leviticus, you know, homosexuality is an abomination. So I just thought it was kind of ironic that the secular people were citing the Bible and the religious people were citing statistics. Anyway, yes.
Well, it seems to me that when he's talking here, and it is parallel to his dreams and his arrogance, mm-hmm. didn't. They thought that they were going to have to take another brother, and he's telling them, "No, I'm
right.
Joseph, and God sent me here to deliver you." And so it's not. It sounds very different if you're starving and your brother says, "Actually, I have some food."
And I have all the not only food. I have all this power. I can do it. You know, I can.
I can help you and be united with your brother, and it just.
It could certainly, you could certainly hear it that way, absolutely. It could be that he's saying, look, you guys don't have to worry because I'm, you know, I carry a lot of sway around here. Yeah.
And I love what you said about it depends on when, because in this interaction, then is when Judah becomes
right. yes.
the chosen one, which is
right.
going to lead us to deal
to the end of it. Right, because remember the previous, back in chapter 38, Judah and the whole Judah and Tamar, that was last year's class. But
right,
which Judah is the one who, more than anyone else, even more than Joseph in some ways, grows through this story, which, as you say, leads then for the, remember, the kingship comes from Judah. So now hurry back to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me without delay. You will dwell in the region of Goshen, where you will be near me, you, your children, your grandchildren, your flocks, your herds, and all that is yours. There, and by the way, when he says you, your children, that means they're all going to be okay. He's their children, right? So he's saying to them indirectly, remember to tell your father that I'm going to take care of you. So that also suggests he's making a promise to his father that he'll take care of his brothers. There I'll provide for you, for there are still 5 years of famine to come. You and your household and all that's yours may not suffer want. Now, remember the quotation marks in the English are not, there's no quotation marks in the Hebrew. So where things start and stop is not entirely clear in terms of his quotations. You can see for yourselves and my brother Benjamin for himself that it is indeed I who am speaking to you. They assume that's because he's speaking Hebrew, right? And you may tell my father everything about my high station in Egypt and all that you've seen and bring my father here with all speed.
I'd like to know why he keeps referring to his father as opposed to our father. Mm.
Well, that's one of the indications that people say Joseph is subtly reminding them of what they did, mm-hmm. right? Because that was, you know, and also I think it's partly. Because there's a sense in which, even though they feel like his brothers, they also don't feel like his brothers. So his relation to his father is independent of them in some sense. I wonder. I understand that it's stylized and that it's and that we're reading a book after all, but I wonder if you think about it, how do you give people this long speech and tell this to your father, right? I mean, you almost imagine either they were memorizing it automatically or they were writing it down. And one of the things, by the way, one of the most interesting ones at the conference was, I don't know if that's spilling or not, one of the most interesting ones at the conference was this Joshua Foer, who's Jonathan Safran Foer's younger brother, wrote this book called Moonwalking with Einstein, where he went to cover a memory conference. There are international memory championships all over the world. And he discovered that the people who participate in this do not start out with exceptional memories. What they do is they master a variety of techniques, all basically the same, although with some variations, that allow them to memorize things that they could never memorize at the beginning. And to make a long story short, he said basically what happened was that it was kind of boring. You know, you see people staring. He says the most action that ever happens at a memory conference is someone goes like this. He said, but that's, so someone said to him, well, if you want to actually get into the action, you have to start learning how to do it. So he learned how to do it and he competed and he ended up winning the American Memory Championship. Then he competed internationally and he said, I got creamed. But he beat the French guy, he said. So just want you to know, I beat the French guy. But he points out that in the ancient world, both these techniques and the practice of memory was very well known. And people would memorize what now seemed to us to be ridiculous things all the time. And in fact, in Jewish society, just like people do in the Muslim world, they memorize the whole Quran. In Jewish society, people would memorize the Mishnah. They were called Tanaim. And they would repeat. And if I was a rabbi who wanted to comment on the Mishnah, I would point to one of the Tanaim and I would say, give me this book, this Mishnah, and rattle it off to me. And the less creative the Tanaim, the better. Because you didn't want them to add their own thoughts. You just wanted them to repeat what the Mishnah was so that you could comment on it. And so when I say, it occurred to me, I was just thinking about that, that when I mentioned this, that it was unusual for them to give a long speech to say, remember it. The truth is, it may have been commonplace because you didn't have memory aids. You couldn't easily write, and you didn't have a computer, and so you had to rely on your ability to actually remember what needed to be remembered. Let me just finish this this last paragraph, and then we'll take any remaining questions or comments. With that, he embraced his brother Benjamin around the neck and wept, and Benjamin wept on his neck. Remember, this is really the first time Benjamin was an infant. It's really the first time that he has seen and knows his brother. He kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. Only then were his brothers able to talk to him. So it wasn't after the speech, it was after the demonstration of his own emotion. Not even of his own emotion, because he wept at the beginning, remember, but his own emotion directed towards them when he held them and they felt again that this is my brother, that they were able to speak. Okay, let's stop there and take questions and comments. First, second, yeah. Right. Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about that. So the usual interpretation of this is in the same way that, what's the right way to put it? Like a personal assistant is kind of a parent to the star, you know? They take care of their needs, they give them advice, they make sure they're okay. That was the kind of role that Joseph played with the Pharaoh. Now, the other way of seeing this is that he's bragging. Depends, you know, or maybe both. They may both be true. Think of it the other way. If you change it to mother, how many secretaries, for example, say that they act like a mother to their bosses? Yeah, all the time. So it's that kind of, that's usually the kind of thing that they're thinking about there. So, yes?
Yeah, it seems like if you look at Joseph's character, from the time he was cast off from his brothers and in so much hardship, that he certainly would shut down and who he is. His roles in Potiphar, in that house, and where he moved on in life, were ones where he seemed to do, you know, above and beyond what was asked of a servant or a slave. Mm-hmm. And as he moved into jail for, again, another accusation that wasn't true, another hardship. And to me, as he moved up to power, Joseph seemed to me, would shut down any emotion that had to do with his own family. He had plenty of time to deal
right,
with.
Right, right.
And to me, this was a cataclysmic event. He finds out his family's alive. Now he has to deal with feelings that were shut down, put down, and buried somewhere way beneath what he can understand. And God had been such a prevalent part of his life. This is something that was cathartic, that I believe he couldn't right. understand, and created the softness that he has toward his brother and his family. Something he deeply needed, but he didn't have
right.
in the environment he was in.
I think that's exactly right, and it makes perfect sense. Which is that Joseph probably didn't know what he felt. To the extent that he thought of them, he probably thought primarily of anger, but obviously they were his brothers. And you can't, you know, it's just like, remember when Jacob and Esau see each other, right? Esau's going to kill him. He's going to kill him. When I see you, I'm going to kill you. And then they weep, right? And then they weep. So it's a nice way to think of human nature, that really that at crucial moments, those warm feelings predominate.
But Joseph did. He took the upper road, it seems like, all the time, even with Potiphar's wife.
Yeah, he certainly took the higher road with Potiphar's wife, right.
Even with the Egyptian leaders.
Right. And we will see if that continues through this. It depends how you, well, that's why for the rabbis, that's how that's why they call Joseph Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph the Righteous, because that's exactly how they see him, you know, which is easier with some biblical characters than others. It's easier with Joseph than, for example, with David, they have to do a lot of fancy footwork to pretend that he was not, you know, what he was, which is kind of like the Godfather. I mean, that's what David was really like. So, but that's another story. Yeah.
I presume the culture in those days is similar to modern Middle Eastern culture, where loyalty to the family is preeminent. Mm-hmm. So that means that the brothers trying to kill Joseph was one of the greatest cultural sins possible. And once they recognized him in Egypt, they knew he was a terrible.
I'm so glad you said that. Did you finish? Okay. So you were saying that culturally one of the greatest sins possible, you know, that Middle Eastern culture and then too, and certainly it's true that in the ancient world family was so important. That's the other explanation for why Joseph sends the Egyptians out, is he doesn't want anyone to think, they're going to think less of him if he says, my brothers tried to kill me. What are they going to think about him? No one's going to want to marry into that family, right? I mean, can you imagine? But that's the vestige of it, is when you think, I mean, every in-law always worries about what family you're marrying into, because you assume that has some, not only because you have to deal with them, but also because you assume that has some reflection on the character of the children. So Joseph doesn't want the Egyptians to know that he came from such a family, because it's a disgrace. Yeah, exactly. Really? They tried to kill their... I mean, it's really bad. They tried to kill their own brother, you know. It's a bad one. Yes?
But he had those dreams. How could he have not shared those dreams?
With whom? Share them with whom?
With his family.
He did. That's why they tried to kill him.
So how could he have not shared those?
With whom?
With his family.
He did. That's why they tried to kill him. That's what I'm saying. At the beginning of the story, he tells them his dreams, and they say, let's kill the dreamer, which is an effective way of making the dreams not come true. But we know, because we've read folk tales, that never works, right? You can take Oedipus and put him out in the wild because there's predicted that he's going to kill his father and marry his mother. And what happens is he gets taken in and he grows up and you don't know him. And then he kills his father and marries his mother. So if you have a dream about what your kid's going to do, the smart thing to do is not try to prevent it, because it's just going to happen. Yeah.
I think frequently we try to keep the dirt of our family within the family. We don't want to expose it to outsiders.
Exactly so. Right. I mean, families do that all the time. You don't, don't tell. Yeah. This is a really difficult, we did talk about it, but there's no resolution about why Joseph does not get in touch with his father over the many years that he's in Egypt. So I have my own pet theory, but the truth is no one knows, okay? Let me just put it that way, and there are lots of explanations and lots of discussions. And I'm not saying that my theory is satisfactory, it's just the best I can do, because I think this is an almost unanswerable question. How could he not get in touch with his father? But I would say this, these are the pieces of the puzzle that make sense to me. His father, remember, notes the fact that he has dreams about his brothers. It says specifically that his brothers hated him, and his father notes it, takes note of the fact that his brothers hate him and that his dreams infuriate them, okay? Then his father sends him out there to check on his brothers when they're pasturing the flock and they throw him into the pit. And then he doesn't know that they went back and told his father they died. What he knows is nobody ever came to look for me. Mm-hmm. So he's thinking to himself, I'm making this up, okay? But just based on clues from the text, I don't know. My father knows my brothers hate me. He sent me to check on them anyway. Mm-hmm. And then when they throw me into the pit and I get sold to Egypt, nobody ever comes to look for me. So he buries those feelings exactly as we were just talking about, and they don't come to the surface anymore until he sees his brothers again. And that's why his first concern is my father still alive? Because maybe he feels some guilt all these years, and I could have gotten in touch with him, and I never did, and boy, I hope he's still alive so that it's not too late.
since he didn't come after me, why, maybe he was dead.
That's also possible. The other possibility is he thought he was dead. Right. Although, if he was that power, and one other possibility is that there's nobody that he can send from Egypt to check on his father without their finding out that his brothers have done this. So that's the other possibility. He doesn't want anyone to know. And he can't go by himself. He's the, you know, he's the vice president. So someone's got to go with him, and servants always talk. We all know this, right? Our servants, yeah, go ahead. It certainly is possible. I mean, he needed time in jail. It's hard to know. I mean, there's so much space in the biblical narrative. There's so much silence and so much emptiness. We don't know what happened to Joseph for 20 years. We don't really know what happened to Joseph. Just like we don't know during those 3 days with Abraham and Isaac walking to the mountain, what happened between them. I mean, you can multiply this. We don't know what happened to Moses growing up. There's so much in the biblical narrative that's not told. But yeah, you could certainly assume that. Yes.
Thinking back to the question I asked you before, the last discussion, the question before this, I'm thinking maybe the way it's written, how is my father, my father, maybe there's some anger and resentment there, and that my father is somewhat sarcastic.
It's hard to know because there's no intonation in the text.
No.
And you know that, here's a good note on which to end. You know that story, it's not a story, it's a joke, about the guy who passes the dry cleaner. And it says, my name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free. So he brings his clothes in, he gives it to him, and comes back a couple days later, and the guy says, that'll be $50. He says, what do you mean it'll be $50? He says, well, you know, it was whatever garments it was. And he says, but it says right in the window, my name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free. And he says, you read it wrong. It's my name is Fink, and what do you think? I wash clothes for free. So it's the same thing here. We have no idea what the intonation is supposed to be, which is why, by the way, the cantillation, the way that you sing the Torah is supposed to matter. Because this is the Jewish tradition later on, right, the Masoretes, trying to decide, this is the 7th, 8th century, trying to decide the way to punctuate the text. Because if you see, for example, the exhibit of the Dead Sea Scrolls, you will see that there's not only is there no punctuation in the Hebrew, there's no separation between words. The Torah is like one long word, you know, except that sometimes there are paragraph and book breaks. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. It's a good point. In other words, now they believe his dreams. Maybe after they come to Egypt and they see him and they're all bowing down to him, they say, "Guys, he's got a point. Maybe he knows what he's talking about." Yeah. Well, it's interesting, actually, that you should say that, because there are, the question was, does anyone think that Joseph might be a messianic figure? The answer is no, not Joseph himself, but in rabbinic literature, there are two different messiahs that are talked about. There's Mashiach ben David and Mashiach ben Yosef. And Mashiach ben Yosef, which is one of the reasons why, what was Jesus' name in the New Testament, Jesus' father's name?
Joseph,
even though he wasn't Joseph's son, right? Again, The Jewish assumption is that the Jesus story is patterned deliberately after the messianic expectations of the Jews at the time. And there is this tradition that there's a Messiah, the son of Joseph, who dies in battle, right? So Joseph does figure messianically in the story, and you can understand why, because remember that for the Jews, the Messiah wasn't a supernatural figure. That's why Rabbi Akiva thought that Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. But when he lost the war, he discovered he was wrong, right? The Messiah was somebody who wins a battle for the Jews, liberates them, and gives them back their state and their temple and so on and so forth. That's why even in the 19th century, some religious Jews, I mean, like, I'm talking religious Jews, thought Herzl might be the Messiah. Not because they saw him working miracles or being resurrected from the dead, but because they thought he might actually. But then, of course, when they saw that it was a political process, many of them turned off of that, because you're not supposed to get the state politically, you're supposed to get it by miracle from God. And when that didn't happen, then, and also because, remember, the state of Israel was founded almost entirely by secular or secularish Jews, Weizmann, Ben-Gurion, all these guys. So there were only a couple of prominent rabbinic figures, Alkali, Kalischer, one or two others, that were Zionists. Most of the really Orthodox world was anti, it wasn't just non-Zionist, it was anti-Zionist, because how can you take on for yourself what God is supposed to do for you? And just as a little twist to this, just to make it more difficult and more painful, the Satmar Rebbe, who was among the most anti-Zionist of anti-Zionists, said that the Holocaust was a punishment for two things, primarily Zionism, but also Reform Judaism. And part of his proof was, where did they both arise? In Germany. And that's where the Holocaust arose, because God doesn't like the idea that you're taking God's job from him, so to speak. You're not supposed to do that. Anyway, so, but obviously not a view that I would expect you to endorse. I hope. Please rise.